You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Hollywood 2019 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's the continuation of Against the Stream by Joy Press. As it happens, Westworld, one of HBO's hottest current dramas, shoots on the very same sets as Deadwood at Melody Ranch. Walking through some of the weathered buildings was confusing. Was I in Deadwood's 19th century Wild West outpost, or Westworld's dystopian simulacrum of one? With a budget said to run $8 to $10 million per episode, Westworld is a beneficiary of HBO's largesse, as Deadwood was back in the day, which allows selected showrunners to construct such vast imaginary worlds. Like Game of Thrones, it took 4 years for Westworld to make it from green light to premiere. At one point, production halted on the debut season to give married creators Jonathan Nolan and Lisa Joy time to get ahead of the writing. Few networks could have afforded this level of patience, but Westworld ultimately became HBO's most-watched first season ever. The way Nolan described HBO's process to me, it sounded almost like a grad school thesis defense. Being forced, every once in a while, to question your assumptions and talk it through almost always makes the thing better. When I visited Blois at HBO's Santa Monica office a few weeks earlier, he queued up a trailer for the network's upcoming shows that included snippets of Euphoria, a jagged drama about drug-addled teen girls starring Zendaya, executive produced by Drake. Also highly anticipated in 2019 is Damon Lindelof's adventurous take on the graphic novel series Watchmen. While there is a lot riding on the slate, Blois sounded blithe. "We've been talking about 2019 for 2 years," he said, clicking off his TV, "and right now we're working on putting together 2020. True Detective, which returned to HBO's schedule in 2019, offers a unique view of the network's creative process. The show's creator, Nick Pizzolatto, was a novelist who had no showrunning experience before HBO backed him. The series' first season in 2014 was a huge hit that invited audience deep dives, and propelled Matthew McConaughey's much-celebrated renaissance. Its rushed to market second season, ran aground in 2015, joining a short list of recent HBO duds that includes the quiet fizzle of Alan Ball's Here and Now and the spectacular flame-out of Vinyl, the series from Martin Scorsese and Mick Jagger, said to have consumed $100 million during the single season that aired in 2016. Many networks would have axed True Detective, but HBO gave Pizzolatto rope to write new scripts. As each new one came in, Blois made Plepler promise not to let on that they were pleased, determined to make sure there was a clear path forward. After 4 good scripts came in, they pulled the trigger on a third season. The network's showrunners all seem to have stories of such finessing. Insecure star and creator Issa Rae had built a following on YouTube with series such as The Misadventures of Awkward Black Girl, but it took a while for her to find her voice at HBO. She was told that the stories that we were leaning on just felt kind of sitcom-y, Ray recalls, and too narrowly focused. Blois says that the breakthrough was making her circle of friends and her boyfriend Lawrence into major characters. Damon Lindelof remembers a note that inspired him to compress an entire episode of The Leftovers into one magnificent 6-minute monologue. And he gets a little rhapsodic when he talks about the leeway HBO has afforded him in developing Watchmen. Although he was in the middle of shooting when we spoke in November, Lindelof said that some of his writers had been working on the show for almost a year, going down blind alleys and hoping to see the light. He regularly uses Bloys, who hasn't read the original graphic novels, as a sounding board to make sure the show's mysteries make sense to comics fans and novices alike. While such spin-offable IP is the current coin of the industry realm, Bloys says he wants an HBO version of a superhero show, dark, provocative, and complex. Along with the Thrones prequel in development, Watchmen seems like the best candidate to keep young viewers and genre obsessives hooked. Yet Bloys insists he wasn't particularly yearning for a superhero show when he started discussing Watchmen with Lindelof. I was more interested in Damon and what interests him. HBO has long revolved around spotting talent and also sticking with it. Bloys says that sometimes he's been inclined to say no to an HBO alum's project, only to have Plepler counsel him, just spend the money. It's a good reminder that talent is sacred. Bloys talks glowingly about writer-performers like Lena Dunham, Danny McBride, and Bill Hader, noting that if you write the script as well as perform the lead role, you've got more control over the weird tone you're aiming for. Anyone who tells you we knew Thrones was going to be Thrones, I'm just here to report to you they're full of shit, Plepler told me when we met. What you know is, this is really good. We believe in these people. And then you hope it finds its way into the cultural conversation. Still, in recent years, HBO has become notorious as a kind of limbo for high-end TV projects. It bought far more scripts than it could afford to make, and then kept creators on permanent hold. HBO is the sugarcane slave trade of TV, Sherman Palladino, who had written a pilot for the network, kvetched to me in 2015. Once they own it, they have first position, for however long. When I mention this reputation for hoarding, Bloys bounces in his seat, eager to explain. This glut amassed before he was in his current position, but he understands how it happened. You have to remember, that was a time when Netflix was just coming up, and people were starting to spend a lot of money, he says. I think it may have been a defensive thing. When he took over programming, one of his first orders of business was to shore up the list. A task aided by an increased budget that allows for more programming hours. While HBO has nurtured talent, it has not always been a particularly equal opportunity support system. For a long time, the network was synonymous with shows about male-dominated subcultures conjured by brooding white male auteurs. Although it had an early hit with Sex and the City, and though it developed pitches with most of Hollywood's great female showrunners, HBO didn't rustle up another female-driven show until Girls premiered in 2012. Its first show, created by a woman of color, came 4 years after that, with the premiere of Ray's Insecure. Several recent additions suggest a concerted effort to find more diverse talent. There's Terrence Nance's wildly poetic variety series, Random Acts of Flyness. Wyatt Cenac's unconventional political talk show, Problem Areas. And LeBron James and Maverick Carter's laid-back barbershop-based talk show, The Shop. Ray is also developing more shows, including a limited series with Laura Dern based on a true story about a battle over Cabbage Patch dolls in small-town Arkansas. Then there's the upcoming Lovecraft Country, a historical fantasy series set in Jim Crow America, created by Misha Green and starring Michael Kenneth Williams and Journey Smollett Bell. Green points out that it will take a sizable budget to make Lovecraft Country come to life. It is a bigger show than Girls or Insecure, she says. You've got to put money behind this thing, and then it becomes a question of value. Are we undervaluing stories that are not about white men? The answer is yes, and it has to change. Ray recalled going to bat for Melina Matsoukas, an African-American director who had never worked in TV before. Casey was seeing my frustrations in finding a director, and he was like, if you have to take a risk, who would you choose? Having someone like Matsoukas, who would back her up culturally, gave her the guts to push her scripts further. Ray jokes that their episodes are full of black references, that white HBO execs don't recognize. Recent examples, Hotep and How Sway, but that they've trusted viewers would get. Obviously, as a gay white man, I don't understand all the things that Issa and her friends are going through, Blois says lightly, but things like love and dating and feeling stuck in a job, if a show is done well, people are going to get it. No matter how adroitly HBO uses its expanded budget and development team, danger looms as the well-funded competition increases. Warner Media announced plans to unveil a new on-demand streaming platform later this year, where it will offer movies and shows from the Warner Brothers and Turner libraries. HBO will be the centerpiece of the service, though viewers will likely also be able to continue accessing shows through HBO, Now, Amazon, Netflix, and cable. Apple will soon be joining Netflix, Hulu, and Amazon in creating the kind of challenging shows HBO invented. And they will all be vying for viewers who have a finite amount of time to devote to watching TV. The network will also be competing to sign creators and performers. That is already leading to an escalating war for talent deals, with streaming services especially eager to lock down shiny names. In the last few years, Netflix has made headlines with record-breaking overall deals. People like Ryan Murphy, Shonda Rhimes, and Marty Noxon, who tend to have multiple projects on the go simultaneously. HBO has taken to showcasing big names in recent years, Reese Witherspoon, Nicole Kidman, Amy Adams among them, but the network originally forged its reputation by creating stars from scratch. Now that Outpost of Weirdos exist all over cable and digital TV, Hello Atlanta, Fleabag, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, HBO can't just gather up all the established geniuses. It will need to keep finding those fresh voices and tapping into the shock of new. At several points in our conversation, Plepler describes HBO as a sort of blue-chip art gallery. When you see an artist who's a derivative of another artist, even when they're good painters, you say, they're copying them, because an original's an original. While discussing his ambitions about what can be achieved on screen, Plepler brought up the way his grandmother used to practice the old Jewish custom of spitting and saying poo-poo-poo when anything good happened to ward off bad luck. So, when Frank Rich sends us an email and he says, the writer's room is great, it's on fire, I'm already thinking, where's Watchmen? Where's Euphoria Episode 2? Poo-poo-poo. Secrets of the Chateau. As the ultimate movie colony clubhouse turns 90, Mark Rozzo prowls among the bungalows and crannies off Sunset Boulevard, where megastars and ne'er-do-wells, from Garbo and Harlow to Lindsay and Brittany, have whiled away nearly a century of enchanted evenings. Opening photo, California Suites. The Chateau Marmont, built in 1929, was intended to resemble a French Gothic-style castle. And Rocker's Roost. Led Zeppelin's John Bonham, Robert Plant, Jimmy Page, and John Paul Jones. Chateau Habitué, 1969. In the late 1920s, as Hollywood was booming and Beverly Hills was sprouting a bumper crop of movie colony mansions, the stretch between them was little more than sagebrush and scrub. It was known as No Man's Land. Walking through it was a forlorn trail with a presumptuous name, Sunset Boulevard. Where this unpaved road met Marmont Lane, catty-corner to an oasis-like complex of villas in mid-construction called the Garden of Allah, the attorney and developer Fred Horowitz became mesmerized by a barren hillside. One day in November of 1926, the story goes, he rolled up to the unpromising site in a town car, pulled out a snapshot he'd taken in the Loire Valley of the Chateau d'Amboise, where Catherine de Medici and Henry II of France shacked up in the 16th century, and in a title card moment from a silent movie shouted, yes. Horowitz had found his spot. Here, on the north side of Sunset, he would build a brawny, earthquake-proof, seven-story, Manhattan-worthy apartment house in a fairy-tale French Gothic style. Thick, buff-colored walls, spiky turrets, steep roofs, arched windows, raftered ceilings, and a vaulted colonnade, with the two flanks of the building folding in upon a grassy courtyard, all adding up to a veritable fortress of luxury, taste, and fantasy. His California castle, distinctively furnished and decorated, as the early ad copy put it, would have state-of-the-art kitchens and bathrooms. Promising Park Avenue-style discretion and privacy, it would be a sanctuary for New Yorkers moving west and for movie mockers desiring East Coast polish. Horowitz toyed with names, Chateau Sunset, Chateau Hollywood. He went with Chateau Marmont. It sounded French. Along with the Garden of Allah, the Chateau Marmont turned that faceless frontier into what would become the Sunset Strip. The Chateau turns 90 this month, having opened its big wooden doors for business on February 1, 1929. It remains a pivotal Hollywood institution, one forever rooted in a pivotal Hollywood moment, the transition from silent films to talkies, from the reigning money 1920s to the breadline 1930s. It's a miracle the place even survived infancy. 8 months after the Chateau welcomed its first tenants, the stock market crashed. Leases fizzled, and 2 years later, Horowitz sold his concrete and steel bauble. Under new ownership, the property finally got traction when its apartments were rented to short-term lodgers, and so the Chateau Marmont became a hotel. But not just any. The Chateau is a grande dame that for nearly a century has remained as intriguing as an ingenue. The hotel says it has no plans to throw itself the kind of blowout party it's so good at throwing for others, such as the Oscar night bash it hosted for Jay-Z and Beyoncé last year. But the Chateau's nonagenarian status comes at a propitious moment. A long-rumored refresh of the hotel's interiors is on the horizon, care of the Paris-based design firm Studio K.O., and under the direction of André Balas, the Chateau's owner since 1990. Studio K.O. designed Balas' acclaimed London property, Chiltern Firehouse. John Krasinski and Aaron Sorkin have been developing a Chateau-inspired miniseries for HBO, with Krasinski saying he hopes it will be about a hotel with secrets, with protection, with history. Those secrets parade through the castle on Sunset, a fabulously fizzy account of the chateau by Sean Levy, who has chronicled the lives of Paul Newman and Robert De Niro, who both lived in the hotel from time to time. Doubleday will publish the book in May. Levy told me he wants to show how the chateau became the perfect place for so many of the things about Hollywood and the music business that we most want to celebrate. The story of the Chateau Marmont, he writes, parallels the story of Hollywood so thoroughly as to be inseparable from it. While periodically flirting with becoming the Norma Desmond of Hollywood accommodations, particularly during the threadbare 1970s, an era that ingrained the hotel in the public imagination as a den of luxury, the chateau is still what it has always been, the place where stars hide out in plain sight. Note the paparazzi pops of Drake or Drew Barrymore or Alicia Vikander coming up the drive, where writers hole up to write or avoid writing, and where pop idols party or sleep it off. The Chateau Marmont is Hollywood's ultimate high thread count clubhouse, part no-tell motel and part royal roost, where bad boys and grandees, bohemians and TMZ trash, novelists and ne'er-do-wells, blue-chip artists and blue-haired ladies congregate, freely mixing with the general public and the staff. It's possible that no hotel in America inspires so much nostalgia, speculation, and sheer devotion. The hotel could have its own chapter in Bartlett's familiar quotations. "I would rather sleep in a bathroom than in another hotel," said filmmaker Billy Wilder, who nearly did just that, persuading the staff to put him up in the vestibule outside the lobby ladies' room during the crowded 1935 holiday season. It was a small room, Wilder noted, but it had six toilets. "If you must get into trouble, do it at the Chateau Marmont," said Columbia Pictures' Harry Cohn, installing the randy duo of Glenn Ford and William Holden in Number 54, the fifth-floor penthouse, in 1939. They were soon joined by David Niven. "I couldn't imagine wanting to commit suicide here anymore," said Eve Babbitts when she first viewed the spiffed-up version of the chateau after Balas took the reins. And here's one from Balas himself, who cribbed from Somerset Maugham. "The chateau stands for all the fables of exotic Hollywood." In November 2017, the New York Times reported hashtag MeToo-related accusations against Balas, including one in which the hotelier was said to have groped actress Amanda Anka at an event in 2014. Representatives for Balas did not respond to these allegations, and he declined to participate in this story. Next, photos, Paradise Lost. The press mob after John Belushi's overdose, 1982. Paris Hilton, 2007. Photographer Helmut Newton, shot by David Fay, 1985. For years, I've played a little parlor game, accumulating factoids about the improbable cast that over time have occupied specific rooms. Penthouse 64, for example, where business magnate and movie maker Howard Hughes liked to hermit himself away, also happens to be where parts of the marvelously dreadful film adaptation of Gore Vidal's Myra Breckinridge was shot in 1969. And also, allegedly, where Greta Garbo lived, signing the register as Harriet Brown. Barbara Streisand, Warren Beatty, and comedian Buddy Hackett all slept here, and all in room 16. "One of these days I'm going to buy this goddamn joint," Beatty vowed. Bungalow 2 is where Nicholas Ray rehearsed Rebel Without a Cause. while a love triangle played out among the middle-aged director and two of his teenage stars, Natalie Wood and Dennis Hopper. In 1959, Errol Flynn went into a drunken rampage in Bungalow 3 a week before he died of a heart attack and, according to the coroner, cirrhosis. Room 36 is where Montgomery Clift hunkered down after his 1956 car accident, emerging onto the terrace from time to scream obscenities in the nude. Courtyard facing 29 is where Myrna Loy made a home for years. Jean Harlow spent the last of her three honeymoons in Suite 32-33. The chateau is where Jim Morrison fell off a roof or balcony or terrace. Nobody seems to know which or when, as did actress and vocalist Pearl Bailey, who conveniently landed on a canvas awning and fell asleep. It's where Dominic Dunn filed dispatches on the O.J. Simpson trial for this magazine from Room 48, now informally known as the Dominic Dunn Suite. It's where country rocker Graham Parsons lived and strummed in Room 47. Dorothy Parker once conked her head on the bathtub there. It's where Betty Davis fell asleep one night with a lit cigarette while watching one of her own movies on TV and almost burned the place down. It's where Lindsay Lohan, in 2012, got sent packing from Room 33 after racking up $46,350.04 in unpaid charges. It's where Sidney Poitier, unable to find suitable digs in 1950s Hollywood, was welcomed with open arms. It's where longtime Vanity Fair photographer Helmut Newton and his wife June lived, in 49, occasionally 39 and 29, and where his heart gave out as he steered a silver Cadillac XRX down the driveway in 2004. And it's where in 1982, John Belushi, aged 33, died in Bungalow 3 following a speedball injection. All in all, it's been a 9-decade saga of glory, shenanigans, and occasional ignominy, played out against a churning cycle of decay, renovation, and reinvention. Even the most high-profile guests were indulging in the romance, said Philip Pavel, a 21-year veteran of the hotel, who stepped down as general manager in 2017 and who was nearly as synonymous with the Chateau Marmont as Palace. "I never get jaded about it," said Sofia Coppola, whose 2010 film, Somewhere, shot mostly in Room 59, is a luminous ode to the chateau and its powerful mojo. She's been coming since she was about 11. Her father, Francis Ford Coppola, would check in for long-term stays. Using the suites and bungalows to get his writing done. He made a pitch to buy the hotel in the 1970s, but balked when he saw the termite report. "It always had a decadent, playful spirit," his daughter told me. Marmophilia is an affliction shared by many who pass through the place. The tasseled key rings, the push-button light switches, the vintage O'Keeffe and Merritt stoves, the Spanish Revival and Art Deco sconces, the craquelure on the 1920s bathroom tile, sometimes just plain cracked. It's all too easily fetishizable. I'm not immune. I found myself hoarding the stationery, upon which Claes Oldenburg, Martin Kippenberger, and Robert Gober have done artwork, along with generations of toddlers. Nosing around to find out who makes that nice firm mattress, Sealy, and the nifty glass Q-tip container in the medicine cabinet, Restoration Hardware. I have also timed the room service, which once turned up at an eerily fast 4 minutes and 25 seconds. The next day, it was 16 minutes and 9 seconds. The journalist, Stinson Carter, who until 2014 worked for 12 years at the chateau as a caterer, pool boy, and bartender, admitted that the hotel's customer service is frankly a bit informal, but very personal. The staff might occasionally space out, but they actually smile and crack jokes. Like the place, they're human. I might not be at the chateau for 18 months, but when I roll up the drive in a rental car, Ray the valet remembers who I am and asks about the kids. Another legendary staffer, the guitar-strumming waiter Romulo Lockie, who died in 2014, had a memorable cameo in Somewhere. The chateau is manicured, up to a point, but it's not about being smothered in luxury. Other fabled hotels in town do a nice job of that. There's the wonderful pink and green fantasia of the Beverly Hills Hotel, with its fountain coffee room. You feel like you're in a Douglas Sirk movie. The Hotel Bel Air is a sylvan hideaway, all flowers and fronds, sleekly refurbished in 2012. The Beverly Wilshire, with its shiny retail corridors, imposing facade, and Michelin-starred restaurant, is L.A.'s plaza. By comparison, the Chateau Marmont, with its scant 63 lodgings, including hotel rooms, bungalows, and garden cottages, is a mere molehill. People like Jim Morrison and David Crosby could have stayed other places, said the actor and director Griffin Dunn, a chateau devotee since boyhood, but they all gravitated toward the chateau for the same reasons the rest of us do. They wanted something more earthbound. They wanted to keep it real. The Chateau Marmont is the pure essence of what Hollywood is. It has an authenticity to it and an aura unlike any other place you can think of. Next, photos. Hello, housekeeping. An array of emblematic ephemera, which shows a tasseled keychain, a please makeup room, door handle hanger, some note paper, and books of matches, and L.A. woman, Bianca Jagger, during a chateau photo shoot, 1979. Dunn remembers being a kid at the chateau in the 1960s and encountering Morrison in the garage. He occasionally stopped in at Penthouse 64 with his parents, producer cum journalist Dominic and wife Lenny, to visit the music executive and gallerist Earl McGrath and his wife Camilla. Here, the boy was handed his first joint and, in late 1966, watched one of the counterculture's seminal clashes with police, the Sunset Strip riots, whose epicenter raged close to the hotel. "We were throwing firecrackers off the balcony," Dunn said. "I loved that. The peasants are revolting," could be heard from other balconies as chateau residents sipped wine and nibbled Triscuits. The McGraths hosted a brunch salon every Sunday, drawing the likes of Sharon Tate and Roman Polanski, who lived below in 54, before moving to Cielo Drive in early 1969. And Dunn recalled the time the McGraths hired a carpenter named Harrison Ford to board up one of their two bedrooms in the hopes of convincing the hotel to cut the rent in half. They succeeded. In 1970, Graham Nash of Crosby, Stills, Nash and Sometimes Young fell for the chateau. "It was a great place to hide," the singer told me. Nash and Joni Mitchell had broken up, and he'd moved out of their Laurel Canyon pad, the one with two cats in the yard he sang about in Our House. He checked into Bungalow 2, intending to stay a couple of nights. He settled in for 5 months. "I fell under its spell of welcoming silence," he said. "If you timed it right, you could actually not see anybody." Amid midnight jasmine and eucalyptus, Nash sat at a Fender Rhodes electric piano as a batch of new songs poured forth, including Stranger's Room, an achy ballad about the rootless vulnerability of the lodger. My eyes were full of morning, and my mouth was full of night. Where do I go from here? A similarly bruised mood is evoked in the Chateau-inspired Room 29, a 2017 album by pulp singer Jarvis Cocker and pianist Chilly Gonzalez. A few years before, journalist Arianna Fallaci had declared the hotel the only elegant place left in town. But by the early 1970s, the Chateau had become a shabby camp treasure, with its orange-brown shag carpet, cheapo fixtures, and Goodwill-grade furnishings. In 1972, the British rock writer Nick Cohn checked into 64. The McGraths had moved on, noticed something weird behind the stove, and pulled out a blood-stained silk kimono. The Chateau, he wrote, was full of corridors and dark corners, aged courtesans, ghost-white junkies. A bona fide ghost who wears a blue robe is also rumored to reside here, but maybe not. Many of the Chateau's tall tales just aren't true. Led Zeppelin, for instance, never did race motorcycles down the halls. The journalist Victor Navasky, who visited in 1974, wrote that the place resembled the girls' dormitory at Swarthmore. He was informed by an unnamed rock star that the office safe was a great place to keep your Coke, presumably not the stuff available by the can from the vending machine next to the front desk, one of the hotel's few amenities. The Chateau didn't have a liquor license until 1992 and didn't open its own restaurant until 2003. In the 1970s, a room could be had for $14 a night, whether you were Carly Simon, Maximilian Schell, Ultraviolet, David Hockney, a guy in from New York peddling a script, or just another player on the long way down. Nobody ever set foot in the lobby back then, Dunn recalled. You might see a mouse running across the carpet. To complete the effect, a mystery man, remembered only as Daniel, answered the front desk phone with a doleful Chateau Marmont that reminded Nash of the Adams family. Michael Lindsay Hogue, considered the godfather of the music video for his pioneering work with the Beatles and Rolling Stones, lived at the hotel for about 15 years, mostly in 29, and described the elusive Daniel. Tall, dressed in black, black motorcycle boots, longish black hair. I got the impression that when he wasn't answering the phone, he was probably quite shy. Daniel's Transylvanian salutation set the tone. When she was 10, Jill Selsman moved into Suite 46 with her mother, actress Carol Lindley. It was 1972. They stayed for 3 years. Selsman, now a writer and television producer, was the Chateau Marmont's own Eloise. Back then, Selsman told me, people came to the Chateau to fall apart. Her next-door neighbor was Graham Parsons, who became her closest adult friend. One weekend in September of 1973, Parsons drove out to Joshua Tree for cosmic inspiration and never returned. He died of an overdose at age 26. Graham, Selsman wrote in a moving essay, was the first person I knew who died just because. In 1975, developers Raymond Sarlat and Earl Cantargian plunked down $1 million for the Chateau. We put an end to the reign of plastic garbage, they later declared, as they refurnished the hotel. Nash came back that year, renting the mid-century modern Hillside Bungalow 3, which, along with its twin, Number 4, was designed by Craig Elwood in 1951. David Crosby moved in with him to perfect the harmonies for their Wind on the Water album. John Belushi checked into Bungalow 3 on February 28, 1982. Tony Randall, given to nude sunbathing in the garden, lived next door in Bungalow 4. Belushi, with his Falstaffian appetites, would spend the last 5 days of his life futzing around with a screenplay about the wine business called Noble Rot, and his nights carousing, drugging, and generally alarming his friends and associates. He befriended a Canadian cocaine and heroin supplier named Kathy Smith, who had been Gordon Lightfoot's girlfriend. He wrote Sundown about her. Together, they partied all night on March 4th, entertaining occasional visitors, including Robert De Niro, then living in 64, and Robin Williams, who swung by after a Comedy Store performance and politely tooted a line. De Niro and Williams made hasty exits. At some point in the morning, Smith gave Belushi the injection that killed him. A concerned De Niro tried repeatedly to reach Belushi through the chateau's front desk, to no avail. "Where's John?" he demanded with rising alarm. "It's really bad," a manager told him. Suddenly, the renowned Chateau Marmont was that seedy joint where John Belushi died. In fact, seedy was used to describe the hotel on the inside flap of the dust jacket of Bob Woodward's 1984 bestseller, Wired, which documented Belushi's final hours in merciless detail. The hotel sued the publisher and got the offending word removed from future printings. Soon, there would be no way anyone could consider the chateau seedy. In 1990, Sarlat and Kantarjian sold the property to Balas, a swashbuckling young hotelier and Manhattan Club impresario, for $12 million. The phrase on everyone's lips was, "Don't change anything." But during the 80s, the hotel had been continuing its slide. Carpets were torn, paint was coming off the walls. Philip Pavel, the longtime general manager, told me that Helmut Newton loved the Gothic nature of the disrepair and sat down with Balas to express his concerns about any refurbishment. As Balas listened solicitously, Pavel recalled, "This giant spring shoots out from the couch they're sitting on." A sensitive, slow-moving renovation was implemented by designers Sean Houseman and Fernando Santangelo, who artfully blurred the line between 1929 and the new. Vintage-style tiles were put in, antique stoves tuned up or installed, ad hoc lighting fixtures replaced, and Jean-Michel Franquesque furnishings scattered about. The bare-bones lobby alcove, where Parsons had posed for the cover of his 1973 album, GP, was swathed in Clarence House and Scalamandra fabrics, and the room transformed into a faux baronial Jazz Age cloister. The staff presented Lindsay Hoag with a mirror from his old apartment as a keepsake, as a new checkerboard floor and piano came in. The whole property had a honey amber glow. Alas, said the right things about the sprucing up. It's a cultural monument, and what happens with it is really a trust. The genius of the restoration, Chateau chronicler Sean Levy told me, was to create a glamorous past that, really, the hotel can barely lay claim to biographically. In some ways, the current chateau is an imposter. For all its abundant lore, the hotel, Levy argued, was merely glamorous in flashes. Yet that intermittent wattage was harnessed to Klieg-like effect. The previous owners kept it together, Levy said, but they didn't exalt it. Many long-timers were impressed and relieved. Helmut and June Newton continued to make the premises home, while Balas made canny use of Newton's kinky chateau photographs. Nudes in the kitchens, on the balconies, in the laundry room, to assert the hotel as a chic zone of frisky mischief. Soon enough, the chateau was gaining more and more notoriety as a place of buzz and celebrity infestation. Pavel described a typical lobby tableau. In one corner is Julia Roberts, taking a meeting. In another corner is George Clooney. And in the other corner is Bono. Stinson Carter said it was essentially a private club for celebrities. He'd look around and say to himself, "There's nowhere on the planet right now that has a higher concentration of iconic people than this place where I am standing." Even the luminaries could be starstruck. In Dominic Dunn's 1997 memoir-like novel, Another City, Not My Own, his alter ego, covering the Simpson trial for Vanity Fair, excitedly tells his son, a lightly fictionalized Griffin, "Courtney Love has the room across the hall from me, and Keanu Reeves has the room next to me." In real life, Griffin said his father once left him a voicemail saying he'd run into Bono, whose name he pronounced like Sonny Bono's. In the elevator, "He knew who I was. He'd read my writing." After the long and sometimes emotionally debilitating task of reporting on the Simpson trial, Dunn packed up Suite 48 and flew home. When he arrived in New York, he immediately rang the hotel. "I'm afraid I've left a pornographic video of a very low-rent nature on the VCR." Dunn asked that it please be removed before the maid saw it. The chateau assured him all would be taken care of and kindly asked if the item should be sent back to him. "Good God, no," Dunn said. As ever, the hotel's discretion saved the day. "You could do things," Sofia Coppola said. Nothing was being reported, except in the hotel log. The up-and-coming director celebrated her birthdays at the chateau and found it the perfect young person's playground. "I remember one night hanging out with some friends," she said, "and going to sleep, and waking up and looking over, and Colin Farrell was smoking cigarettes on the floor next to my bed. She had no idea who he was or how he got there. It was like a clubhouse," she said, "and back then everything wasn't documented, thankfully." That changed soon enough. "There was one year where the paparazzi doubled in size," Pavel recalled. "Then Lindsay Lohan checked into the chateau, and that," Pavel told me, "was one of the moments where things were really intense. Britney Spears checked in. Paris Hilton checked in. Now it was velvet rope time. The tabloid 90s had metastasized into the social media 2000s. The Instagram era has changed the dynamic, I think, forever," Pavel said. He made attempts at preserving a semblance of hominess and privacy, prohibiting employees from posting about or tagging the hotel, banning a guest for tweeting about another guest's misbehavior. But the notion of privacy, the chateau's trademark, began to seem as quaint as needlepoint. When Pavel started seeing real housewives turning up in the chateau's storied precincts, he said his knee-jerk impulse was, "Get off my lawn!" As ever, the chateau was mirroring the evolution of Hollywood. Stinson Carter, who is working on a memoir about his time at the hotel, recalled watching the era of analog celebrity dying before his eyes, night after night. "You went from having a private hotel to a hotel that was assailed by paparazzi to a hotel where the celebrities themselves, armed with phone cameras, were their own paparazzi." The amiable 20-something bartender from Louisiana had grown accustomed to having Joan Baez invite him in to chat about the 60s, or sitting with Radiohead's Johnny Greenwood as he strummed a guitar, or talking about books and politics and life with Hunter S. Thompson or Swedish actor Stellan Skarsgård. There might be invitations to joint penthouse revels. These weren't like lemonade socials, you know, or a good-natured wrestling match with a Golden Globe winner. "All of these experiences," Carter said, "they happened because these people knew that I didn't have a device in my pocket that was spying on them." The chemistry between a glittering registry of guests and a young, talented staff, who might have literary agents or IMDb listings, could be weird and wonderful, but there were understandably new barriers. The chateau, in some ways, was growing up and turning yet another page. In the mid-90s, the average price of a room was about $150. These days, a standard one-bedroom suite goes for about $950 a night. The sixth-floor penthouse, $5,000. The grassy courtyard has been tinted over like a seraglio and strung with silk fortune lamps. There are more amenities, more sticklerish service, and higher expectations from well-heeled visitors who might not appreciate the charm of 1929 bathroom tile. As ever, the rallying cry is "Don't change anything," which Balas seems well aware of, again proceeding slowly, as he did in the early 90s. "There will be an outcry," Griffin Dunn cautioned, "if it's not exactly right." "Not to get all California Nutburger on you, but everything changes," said Pavel, who became the managing director of the Nomad Hotel in downtown L.A. in 2017. "The chateau will continue to be the chateau. It'll continue to live and become whatever it is to the next group of people that are there." One day, toward the end of his long tenure at the chateau, Pavel got a call from the front desk saying that Led Zeppelin's Robert Plant was in residence and would like to meet him for coffee in the garden. "I was like, it's effing Robert Plant," Pavel recalled, "who just wanted to say thank you, and so we sat and talked." Plant told Pavel about how in early 1969, during Led Zeppelin's first tour in the United States, he touched down at LAX and came straight to the chateau. "I imagined him in that tiny vest with no shirt and that wonderful cascade of curls," Pavel said. Plant, according to Pavel, told him that he strolled up in bare feet, taking in Sunset Boulevard and the castle perched above it, and thought, "I've found my people." Like Fred Horowitz decades earlier, and like so many visitors since, Plant, on that spot, had had his yes moment. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.